Surely we are not blind, are we? Every one of us here this morning can see. We all have our physical sight, some to greater degree than others. But sometimes we say, oh, now I see. And we're not talking at all about physical sight, but we're talking rather about insight or new understanding. We feel like somehow we've been enlightened. What was once unclear now made more clear to us. We are called to light, to greater understanding, to live in truth, to walk in the light. Ephesians, from the Pauline letter in verse 8 of chapter 5, says this: for once you were darkness, but now in the Lord you are light. Live as children of light, for the fruit of light is found in all that is good and right and true. To be children of light supposes that we have a parent who is light. And Jesus lived most fully into that light, in light of his parent light, God. And he lived as a model of the fullness of humanity living in the light. The last number of weeks we've been in John's Gospel. And John's Gospel begins with a reference to light. The light was the life of all people. The light shines in the darkness, John says, and the darkness did not overcome it. Joyce asked us this morning what we saw when we got up and on our way here. We all understand perhaps something of that miracle of light, that what we really see are actually beams of light bouncing off the object and into our eyes. Hard to believe, but true. The light rays enter the eyes through the cornea, which is thick, transparent layer on the surface of your eye. And then the light rays pass through the pupil, the dark circle at the center of your eye, and into the lens of the eye. And that's just really the beginning of the sight process, which also involves the vitreous humor, the retina, the rods and the cones, the optic nerve, the visual cortex, part of the brain. All of this working together to deal with this bouncing rays of light. Amazing, this thing of physical sight. But the fact of our humanity is that with physical sight as well as other sight, our sight is never perfect. Not in the physical sense, not in the spiritual sense. We sometimes see too much, we sometimes see too little, we sometimes see the wrong things. Sometimes we are blind, sometimes we have partial truth. And we all know there are at least two kinds of blindness. The one is a kind of physical blindness of this man in the story, this amazing, complex, six-act little story that you heard this morning. Blind from birth, he's living in a world of darkness, never seeing a sunrise or the first crocus of spring or a daffodil or the face of a child. And yet we all know of many examples of people who live their entire life without physical sight, leading productive lives. But still something of our heart goes out to people who are physically blind. But another kind of blindness is that moral or spiritual blindness that we saw in this, so exemplified in the story, like these righteous leaders from our text. They were unable to see and celebrate the work of God among them, blind to who was the light of the world in this story. Perhaps in the story from John's perspective, equally or maybe more tragic than the blindness of someone blind from birth physically. But at the end of the story, there's at least a glimmer of light that comes through even these religious leaders who begin to ask the insight question of new sight, at least the potential for new sight. Surely we are not blind, are we? Blindness and sight are explicitly mentioned in 24 of this chapter's 41 verses, including the first and the last verses. And the details of the miracle are actually repeated four different times. This man put mud on the eyes of the blind, and then this man regained his sight. And at the center of the narrative, standing before the healing and after the healing, is Jesus. And notice that he sort of comes into the first act and then again back into the last act as the giver of sight and the very light of the world, in which true light and sight and insight becomes possible. And here we have a blind man, blind from birth, utterly without sight, and quickly tragedy turns to theology. You seem to know this dynamic as well as I do. We've seen it played out time and time again. Something happens, and what do we instinctively do? We theologize. God, what did I do to deserve this? Why has this happened to me? And here the theological question is, Jesus, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Theological liberals say his parents, grandparents, and whole society sinned. A racist, uncaring, unjust society did it to him. While conservatives say, no, this man has no one to blame but himself. It's his sin, whatever it was, that led to this punishment. And a debate breaks out between progressives and conservatives. And you've seen it. There are too many examples. It seems that after every national tragedy, there's somebody that wants to theologize and explain away what just happened. We seem to be desperate to theologize, to make sense, to hold someone else responsible for something that makes no logical sense to us. And we ask in our own way, Jesus, who sinned here? We want to know. But Jesus is having none of it. None of this cool, detached theologizing for him. No sitting around discussing other people's pain. Rather, he proclaims that this man's situation is an opportunity to get a glimpse of the light of God's glory. He's about to shed some healing light on the subject with a bit of spit and dirt and a loving touch. He heals the man. Darkness turned to light. Glory. And the man squints and blinks and praise God, he sees. Now all the people, the crowds, the religious leaders, everyone is happy and rejoices with this man. Right? Wrong. A fresh theological debate breaks out. Whoa, wait a minute, dear Jesus. Now, tell us again, from what medical school did you graduate? Surely you have at least a doctorate in ministry, right? PhD, preferably. What? Not even a Master of Divinity? And what's this business about forgiving sins? And that's probably exactly what John wants us to do, and is to go ahead and ask the question, who is this Jesus anyway? The healing is done in a couple of verses in the text, and the healing ought to be the end of this blind man's problems. But no, it's just really the beginning. More verses are given to the argument after the healing than the actual healing. Who is this? Who is this? But who really is this? Now, well, I can't answer that for you, says the blind man. I don't really know what happened or how it happened, but all I know is that once I was blind and now I see. You know the song Amazing Grace? I once was lost, but now I'm fine. Found was blind, but now I see. That's really all I know. And then they grab the parents. Is this your son? There's got this kid running around saying that he's been healed, trying to make something big out of this guy, Jesus. And they look at each other and back at them. Well, they say, well, he kind of looks like our son. Though we can't say for sure, really, but go ahead and ask him. He's an adult. And the Pharisees respond, well, we're going to have to kick him out of the temple, the synagogue, for participating in unapproved illegal healing. He's going to need to be banned. And so they put him out. So he's cut off now from his community, no small thing. And this once blind man, now visionary, out of the church. Isn't it ironic? But you remember, don't you, that John's gospel is full, chock full of irony. Grown people being reborn, living water offered to questionable outsiders. And now this unauthorized healing and touching and insight and sight. Light to the world, okay, fine, so long as it shines in acceptable darknesses. The light shines in the darkness, John says in the first chapter, but light is hard to contain and control. Sometimes when we want to project something on the wall here in this beautiful, bright room, we try to get a little bit darker by pulling the shades, but still the light shines, can't be fully contained. Now, it'd be easy to get hung up in this story, just like the disciples and most everyone else in the story. We're not called to focus on how or why this man was born blind. These things happen. The real story is that about being blind, not from birth, but blind to rebirth. We were given the gift of sight at birth, but can we see rebirth happening within and around us, or are we blind to that? Maybe we're more like Nicodemus of a couple of weeks ago, that we just can't kind of wrap our minds around this phenomenon of how in the world can someone who is an adult be reborn or born from above when he or she is fully grown and old. Anne Lamott, beloved author to many of us, gained her spiritual sight after years of being strung out on alcohol and drugs. And she writes in one of her books, and I quote, "You can safely assume you've created God in your own image when it turns out that God hates all the same people you do." End quote. The Pharisees thought they knew God. They thought they knew what God was up to in the world and what God's will was for the world. They were the gatekeepers of the Jewish religion, the bishops, so to speak, the cardinals, and they were good at it. And so this story is about Jesus, but it's also a story about those who are the keepers of the religion. Those who do not do well at disruptive, uncredentialed healing. the author John Dominic Crossan, in his study of the historical Jesus, speaks of Jesus causing controversy because he offered what Dominic Crossan calls a brokerless kingdom. Jesus invited all to the table. He offered the power of God to everyone, regardless of their low social status or their poverty, regardless as to how others were perceiving these folks. And this, says Crossan, accounts for why Jesus ran into trouble with the authorities and why he was finally crucified. The authorities of any age are the gatekeepers, the brokers of power. They are therefore threatened by any hint of that power for healing and well-being made available other than officially certified channels. This should be a particular indictment on folks like myself, as we see ourselves as the gatekeepers of religion and Christianity in our world. And it is. And we should ask ourselves the question as leaders, as spiritual leaders, what are we doing to make this brokerless kingdom inaccessible to certain people in our society? And ask that question that the Pharisees were beginning to ask at the end of this story. Surely, we are not blind, are we? For Jesus offers his brokerless kingdom for all to share. It seems that one of the disciplines that we need to perhaps engage in this Lenten season is maybe the discipline of prayer and fasting. Sometimes fasting, refraining from food, hones our ability, makes us more sensitive and alert to new ways of seeing, to new understanding, to new insight, with the eyes of our heart enlightened. Some of you know, and many of you know, the name J. Darrell Byler. He's the executive director of the Center for Justice and Peace Building in Harrisonburg at Eastern Mennonite University. Darrell, a lawyer, a pastor, someone who's lived extensively in the Middle East, began on Ash Wednesday a 40-day water and juice fast. And he writes, and I quote, extended part from Darrell's blog. He says this: "The recent presidential election laid bare the ugly fissures that are ripping the nation apart. Far from our stated national vision, out of many one, e pluribus unum, we are rapidly losing the ability to see the humanity in those from a different political party, economic class, racial group, sexual orientation, or immigrant status than our own. Systemic injustices are rooted in a hierarchy of human value, and civil discourse across differences has become a rare commodity. Between Ash Wednesday and Palm Sunday, as God enables, I plan to engage in a water and juice fast. Each day, sending an open letter to President Trump, calling on him to act collaboratively with other national leaders for healing justice. The letters will be rooted in the daily office texts from President Trump's Presbyterian faith tradition. While the divisions and disparities in the country existed long before President Trump took office, he bears unique responsibility in his very public role for setting a positive tone and leading by example. Still, all of us, from the most progressive to the most conservative, are responsible to take concrete steps to heal the national divisions and work for justice for all. President Trump campaigned on the slogan, "Make America Great Again." What would it look like to be a great nation? The biblical prophets define greatness as learning to act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly. Jesus spoke of greatness as learning to serve the needs of others, feeding the hungry, including our enemies, visiting the sick and imprisoned, and welcoming the stranger. Many other religious traditions share these same values. I invite others to join me in this time of prayer and fasting for a meal, a day, several days, or even longer, and take practical steps, however large or small, toward healing justice. Written by J. Darrell Byler on February 28th, 2017. Where are the areas in your life or our congregation's life where we need new sight? Where do we need to be asking this question, the same question the Pharisees were asking? Surely we are not blind, are we? And I can imagine Jesus with a mischievous twinkle in his eye, avoiding the temptation to say, "Duh." The Sunday school series that we've embarked on, thanks to Ron Hertzler a number of weeks ago on the subject of racism, has had me pondering time and again in the last several weeks. How in the world did I not see what was happening right under our noses in regard to racism? And when it comes into your own family, you begin to ask the question in brand new ways. May God give us all the grace to so open our hearts and minds to the life-changing light of Christ, that we too may, with renewed vision and worship, be able to see the light among us, the light that overcomes the darkness. For when Christ truly dwells within us and our lives are open to this life-changing presence, darkness cannot dwell, because there is no darkness where Christ is. Amen.